despite my slightly under the weatherness, I'm really excited to be able to share with you this morning. As I said earlier, we're going to be continuing, in fact, finishing our series today on embracing faith, thinking about what does it look like, what difference does it make to have faith in 2023. And over the past 5 weeks, we've explored lots of different topics. We've talked about a perspective of faith which sees an opportunity where the world sees needs. We've talked about a faith where we've got togetherness and community, where the world sees otherness and isolation. We've talked about a faith which embraces the peace of God rather than the war of the world. We've talked about a faith which roots itself in a stable God in a world which is ever-changing. We've proposed then that faith makes a great difference in the world today. Faith, a Christian faith, embraces love, community, and reconciliation. It offers us a port in the storms of life. It has done for so many of us, can do for so many others. But faith really does make a difference. That's what we've said, and that's what we've discussed, that's what we've learned. Those are substantial claims, and I hope they've been enough to remind us and encourage us of the role that we can play as a church community centered around a shared faith in the world today. We're not just shouting into the wind. We can be a real presence. I believe we are a real presence as people of God in the world for all those reasons. So we've already made that case. What then is really the point of me talking today? We could just celebrate and be like, yay, we've heard lots of great things about the difference faith makes in the world. Well, today I'm going to throw you a little curveball, something to think about in light of all the other stuff that we've talked about and thought about and reflected on and read about. I've really indulged myself this morning. So I hope this is going to be both challenging and encouraging. And I hope that's true because I have indulged myself. But I'm going to be talking about something which for me is one of my most highly valued character traits. I'm going to be talking about it using my favourite book of the Bible. So it's a little bit self-serving here. Or it's using what's kind of inherently me to share something to you, whatever your perspective is. But just for 20 seconds, just to get you kind of reflecting, just take 20 seconds, turn to the person near you, with you, and ask them what their favourite book of the Bible is and why. Keep it succinct. But yeah, what's your favourite book of the Bible? Okay, if the other person hasn't had a go already, maybe change over, share a little bit, 10 seconds. Okay. Well, that gives you something to talk about afterwards as well. I hope that was enlightening. I think what someone's favourite book of the Bible is tells you a lot about a person. I wondered whether there's a comparison about, like, you know, people who've got dogs and their dogs are quite often like their owners. It's a bit like that. You're a bit like your favourite book of the Bible. My favourite book of the Bible is not particularly a popular choice. I'd be surprised if there are many others here who share my opinion. But it's the book of Job. The kind of questioning quiet suggests that it's not the most popular. Job isn't as exciting as the narrative you get in Genesis, the creation and all that great stuff. It doesn't have the journey of Exodus through the desert and the wilderness. It doesn't have the richness of law that you get in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. It doesn't have the sex and murders you get in the story of David or the blatant wisdom of Solomon. It doesn't have the spies and invasions of other books of the Old Testament. And then you get to the New Testament. It hasn't got the gospel truth of Jesus. It hasn't got the miracles and the parables. Job is an odd and long narrative. You might struggle to get through it. It's 42 chapters and it takes a bit of reading. But for me, Job is something that's deeply human. It feels very relatable. And ultimately it asks a series of questions related to one great question, which we'll come to. We're going to be looking at the story of Job because my topic for today is question and answer, or questions and answers. one of the reasons why Job's story appeals to me is because at its core, it's a story about a group of mates who are just sitting around asking each other questions. They're talking theology. They're asking questions of God. And then they're listening to one another and they're coming up with other ideas and they're bouncing around a bit. But aside from the enormous trauma which Job goes through, which I'll come back to, there's a sort of friendship group I'd like to have. We just sit around and, you know, when something big happens in someone's life, they take time to sit together and talk through, you know, why is this happening? What? How do we understand our circumstances? It's question and answer, question and answer. This is the heart of Job. It's about the conversation. Most of the text is questions and answers between this group of friends. So I'm going to try and offer, I'll do a brief synopsis in parts of the story of Job. I'm going to look at the use of questions and answers in Job and reflect on that and try and think about what that shows us about the use of questions and answers in a life of faith today. So I'm just going to start by reading the first bit of chapter 1, which begins to set the scene for us and introduces our main character. So in Job 1, chapter 1, verse 1. There was once a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who had feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and very many servants. So this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold feasts in one another's houses in turn, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the feast days had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This is what Job always did. So we meet Job, and he is well rich. I mean, I know kind of old wealth doesn't really translate into our metrics today, but this guy had 3,000 camels. That's a lot of camels. I don't know how much a camel costs, but I'm assuming this guy's got some money. But not only is he incredibly well off, not only with possessions, but he's got lots of family and servants and great stuff. But he's also got the other side of things. He's a great guy. He's called blameless and upright. I don't know about you when you hear that, but that, as I read it, rang a bell. It sounds familiar to me. So I looked into it. And there are others that God calls blameless and upright. Noah, in Genesis 6, is introduced in this way. It says, Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time. A little further along the story in Genesis, we get to Abraham, who becomes Abraham. And he's introduced, he's described like this. When Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless." There are more examples, but this shows from the outset that being blameless, being righteous, living an upright life, these are standards that have been set. A high standard that God sets us and a standard that Job meets. He's blameless. So as we continue the story of Job, this idea of being blameless is particularly interesting because in our narrative, we get something very unusual, not for the first time in Job and not for the last time in Job. There's some heavenly beings that come to God, including one called the Accuser. Now, if you've got different translations of the Bible, if we're all reading from our own phones or books, whatever, your translation might say Satan. This could be a much bigger point. I could spend lots of time on it. I'm not going to. I'm going to try and keep focused. But just as a quick aside, if it does say Satan, there'll be a footnote next to it which says something like, meaning the adversary, or Hebrew meaning the adversary, or the accuser. And in the ancient Jewish language and ideology, there was not an individual called Satan that we think of. The Satan was, ha-satan was the word, the Satan was a role that someone could play if you were against God or against God's people, an adversary, an accuser. Anyone could fulfill that role. So when it's using this, it teaches us two things. We think of Job as being one of the oldest written texts. As a lot of scholars would argue, it's one of the oldest texts. This suggests that either it's been altered to kind of bring it into a more modern idea. The idea of Satan as an individual character doesn't come about until about the 2nd or 3rd century BC, potentially like 1,000 years after some people think this text was put together. Or that it's talking about something different completely, just another character who's the accuser, and there's a linguistic coming together. I think probably the most helpful thing I thought, I didn't come up with this, was that this is a story that's as old as people think it is, an ancient story. Once you see its core themes, it's asking a question about the problem of suffering. How long has there been suffering? Well, as long as there's been people, there have been suffering. And I'm sure as long as there's been people suffering, there's been people asking about why there's suffering. So this could well be a story that's been told and retold down through the ages. And the recording that we have of it, which has this language of the accuser, could be that that's just one iteration which fits the kind of the ideas of the time it was recorded. So that's one way of understanding that. But what's relevant in all of that is that it's this character, the accuser, we see in the story, he speaks to God and says, God's kind of really proud of Job and saying, look at Job, he's amazing, he does such good things, he's so such a righteous man. And the accuser says, well, that's just because he's got everything. He's got everything he could ever dream of. He's got all these 3,000 camels. What else could he want? And so God says, you know, they kind of come to an agreement that, yeah, I'm sure, take away his things, he will still be a good person. So the accuser has free reign to do that. Takes away all his possessions. His children die. Yet Job refuses to become bitter. He doesn't get angry with God. Still, he praises God. So God again is proud of Job and says, look, all these things, and still he is faithful. Still he is righteous. And the accuser says, well, yeah, okay, he can live without all of these things, and people are counted among these things. It's not ideal, but that's how it is. But if you were to hit him where it hurts, his body, his person, really afflict him personally, then you'll see what he's really made of. And God says, okay, fine. You can do anything. Just don't take his life for anything else. And so that's basically what happens. Short of losing his life, he's afflicted. He's lost everything. He's covered, it says, from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. These incredibly painful sores. I can't imagine what he was going through. Not only emotional pain, but physical pain. He's in complete discomfort, distress. So the question, well, not the question for today, but something fun to think about is, if Job is blameless, which we're confirmed that he is, he told at the start he's blameless, and we see the process by which he's afflicted, he's got nothing to do with it. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's not asked for it. He's blameless. Who is to blame? Some will say the accuser for inflicting it. Some might say God for allowing the accuser. The accuser doesn't have the power until God says, go on, do it. You can muse on that if you want. Just a small question for the morning. We're not going to get into that, but we are going to think about Job. He's left in this state, sat there, pain, everything. And God says nothing. God doesn't offer him comfort. God doesn't come and explain. Job's just left there to suffer. For better or for worse, Job's mates turn up. Don't know if you've ever been through something really difficult. And then some mates turn up, some friends come along trying to comfort you. And sometimes they can. And sometimes they can just make things worse. This, I think this is a bit of both. Job's friends can't help but wonder why these things have happened. Which is natural. You see a friend in need and you think, why? Why has this had to happen? But they don't just wonder in their heads and then pat him on the shoulder. They wonder aloud, which is not particularly sensitive given the circumstance. But we get from chapter 3 through to chapter 37, this long back and forth, they say questions. Job, are you sure you haven't sinned or done something to upset God? Maybe that's why this is happening. No, I'm telling you, I've done nothing wrong. Are you sure you haven't done this thing? Or they're trying to make sense of it. They're trying to make sense of the situation. They're trying to make sense of a God that would create that situation. It's questions followed by answers, followed by more questions. There's so much going on in amongst this text. It's hard to know what to take away from it. I love Job, but it's not necessarily a blatant, okay, here's the key point, I'll take this away. Here's my verse I'll put on my wall. But there is, within the text, something of a secret roadmap to identify the key point. I say it's a secret. It's not really a secret, but that just makes it sound more exciting because it's not obvious. What it is something that you discover through a particular way of textual analysis, which sounds boring, but it isn't boring. So I say it's a secret roadmap. I think I've got a picture of this. Paul, if we have to pull that up. But the text of Job is a chiasm, this word called a chiasm. It's a fancy word, which basically just means a literary structure where points are made and repeated in reverse order. A, B, C, C, B, A, something like that. And there's a kind of a bringing of the problem and a resolving of the problem. So you can see the kind of mirroring of themes from point A at the start to point A at the end, B. And what you'll see is these structures, these chiastic structures, they point you to a center. And the center of our text in Job is kind of like the tip of a big arrow pointing, saying this is it. Center of Job is in chapter 28. Herein lies the mystery of Job. Everything else kind of finds a question and gets resolved with an answer of some kind. Apart from that center verse, center chapter of 28. Job 28 is also fairly unique in that it's an interlude. Imagine that. I couldn't believe I was reading it this week. And I'd forgotten that was, that's mad, isn't it? It's the middle of this story and it just says interlude. And it's this completely other thing and it picks back up in the story. I can't think of any other examples in the Bible which does this. But this makes it highly unusual and highly interesting. So what does it say in Job 28? I'm just going to read it. I'm going to read Job 28 all the way through. Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold to be refined. Iron is taken out of the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Miners put an end to darkness and search out to the farthest bound the awing gloom and deep darkness. They open shafts in a valley away from human habitation. They are forgotten by travellers. They sway suspended, remote from people. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the places of sapphire, and its dust contains gold. That path no bird of prey knows, and the falcon's eye has not seen it. The proud wild animals have not trodden it. The lion has not passed over it. They put their hand to the flinty rock and overturn mountains by the roots. They cut out channels in the rocks, and their eyes see every precious thing. The sources of the rivers they probe, hidden things they bring to light. But where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Mortals don't know the way to it, and it's not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be gotten for gold, and silver cannot be weighed out as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, or in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The chrysolite of Ethiopia cannot compare with it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? And where is the place of understanding? It's hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and death say, we have heard a rumor of it with our ears. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight, and apportioned out the waters by measure. When he made a decree for the rain and a way for the thunderbolts, then he saw it and declared it, and he established it and searched it out. And he said to humankind, truly the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. As we're caught up in this narrative of Job, questions and answers and questions, we get this central focus point where we're meant to be thinking about wisdom. Chapter 28 describes beautifully how wisdom isn't something we can source. We can't mine it. We can't dig for it. We can't buy it. Like the other precious things of the earth that we can attain through some mean or other, wisdom rests with God alone. That's the central point. That's the key takeaway from the book of Job. This is what we're meant to understand in amongst all these questions and answers and questions and answers. I expected to stand here today, as we have done with other of these talks, and contrast and say, the world has questions, and people of faith, we've got answers. But I can't tell you that. That's not been my experience. That's not true of my understanding. You see, the story of Job, we're reminded Job hasn't got any answers, only questions. Is it the friends of Job who are meant to represent us? I really hope not. Not only they're a little bit obnoxious, but God rebukes them. As we come to the conclusion of the story, he tells them off. He says, after the Lord has spoken these words to Job, so he hasn't answered questions, but he's just spoken to Job. The Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. The only righteous one among them was Job, and he had only questions and doubt. It was God alone who has the answers. I think it remains so. Perhaps then, the gift of faith is not that we find answers to the questions of the world, but that we find questions to the answers of the world. Faith serves as a lens through which we can see life and see the world. It does not allow for easy answers. Generation after generation throughout history have put forward their best ideas, their answers, ideologies and structures. None of them have withstood the questions that a life of faith brings. The world's tried to come up with answers with autocracy, democracy, capitalism and communism, socialism and fascism. We've tried conservatism and liberalism, but free love and rock and roll and punk. No matter what we've tried, regardless of time, regardless of place, the answers of the world fall short. A faith perspective is a wide perspective. It's one which is rooted in love, in compassion, and in mercy. When the answers of the world fail to meet those standards, which they inevitably do, it is the questions of the faithful which bring cracks to their certainty. Questions rooted in God's heart of love, of compassion and mercy, have the power to dismantle the structures and powers of the world. Some of our great modern heroes of faith are those that have dared to ask questions of power structures. They've asked questions of the world's answers, which have seen them crumble. Now, we might think here today that we live in a time after Job. As I said earlier, God alone has answers. And we've got this connection with God. We've got the God of answers. But I want to put it to you that God didn't answer the questions of Job. And there's a reason for that. God silenced Job, and God spoke to Job, but God didn't address and answer his direct questions. God says things like, where were you when the foundations of the earth were laid? These huge statements don't answer questions, but they remind us who God is. God reveals their wisdom, as we heard in chapter 28, that center point, a focus on wisdom. God's wisdom comes in God's response. Our answers fall short, just as Job's friends' answers fall short of God's truth, precisely because we're not God. God speaks to Job, as God speaks to us now, to remind us, I am God. The God of Job then is one who hears our questions, the deepest cries of our heart, and reminds us who they are. I am God. I was there when the foundations of their world were laid. I was there when the great beasts were created. I alone have the power and the wisdom. In asking questions, we can follow that line of Job, the example that Job sets. And in so doing, we can find our right place in relationship with God. The inquisitive mind of a child who asks questions of their parent. It's those who seek to provide certain answers that God reprimands. In the story of Job, we must be careful. We must be a questioning people. We should question why there's suffering in the world. We should ask why there is inequality, hunger, pain all around us. That's the example that Job sets us. So we can't be afraid to ask big questions. And we can't accept the easy answers that the world tries to offer because they fall short of the truth and the power of God. And ultimately, above all, we have to remember that true wisdom comes from God alone. I'm just going to pray. Lord, continue to remind us of your wisdom. Thank you that it's not up to us to find the answers, to hold that responsibility. You alone have that wisdom. You alone have the answers to the questions of life. But may we follow the example of Job, a heart that's hungry to know you, to understand you more. May we be people who ask questions of the world, that set it to your ways, not our ways. Questions which reveal your love, your compassion and mercy. May we be a people that are continuing to search for you in all areas, in all things. May our trust be in you alone, Lord. In your name we pray.